Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The baby business, sperm donors in particular, are back in the cultural spotlight. The Kids Are All Right is the marquee summer movie for Hollywood director Lisa Cholodenko. It's about a California lesbian couple, an interloping sperm donor dad, and two kids' curiosity about where they came from. It's also about our culture and how we now look at parenting and parentage. Some conservatives are uneasy with sperm donation creating non-traditional families. Hollywood has its own view. So maybe do the kids. This hour On Point, sperm donors, who's a daddy and what's a family? You can join the conversation, what is a sperm donor when it comes to family? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Opening in theaters this month, the movie The Kids Are All Right stars Annette Bening, Julianne Moore, and Mark Ruffalo. It's about two lesbian women whose family takes on the complications of anonymous sperm donation when the donor shows up.
The plan was to limit his involvement.
You're not going to stick that, bro.
He's not a father. He's our sperm donor.
He's not a father. He's our sperm donor, and things get tricky. Joining me now from Brooklyn, New York, is Stephanie Zaharek. She is chief movie critic at MovieLine.com, recently wrote about The Kids Are All Right. Stephanie, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So this film is getting a lot of advance buzz, opening over the next week or two around the country. Why so much attention?
Well, I think for one thing, it is definitely, as you noted, about what we'd call a non-traditional family. And one thing that I think is very interesting about it is that, basically you have these two teenage kids who decide to seek out their sperm donor father, who's played by Mark Ruffalo, and he agrees to meet them kind of casually. I don't even think he thinks about what he might be getting into, and discovers that he kind of likes them and wants to see them again and wants to build a relationship with them. But, of course, that also means building a relationship with the two moms, Annette Bening and Julianne Moore, and that's where the complication comes in.
Well, how does that go? The sperm donor, quote-unquote dad, I don't know what we call him, trying to build a relationship with the two moms in 2010 America.
Well, it becomes very complicated, as you'll see if you look at the film. But, one of the things that I think is really interesting about it is that it, even though it is somewhat about the children's experience of, finding their father, getting to know him, getting to realize that he's an imperfect human being, it is very much about the relationships between the adults, the three parents. So instead of being about, how is this, the introduction of the father on the scene, how is this going to affect the children, how is it going to traumatize the children, it really is about, mostly about, how the adults deal with it. And it's very complicated, but it's also quite wonderful, and it really is a movie about the resilience of human beings and the resilience of families.
Let's hear a little bit from the film, The Kids Are All Right. Two lesbians, Nick and Jules, tight couple, live in Los Angeles with their two teenage children, Joni, named for Joni Mitchell, and Laser. The kids sort of set everything in motion by seeking out their once anonymous sperm donor dad to the surprise of their moms. Jules, played by Julianne Moore, and Nick, played by Annette Bening.
Laser, your mom and I sense that there's some other stuff going on in your life. We just want to be let in.
What do you mean?
Are you having a relationship with someone?
You can tell us, honey. We would understand and support you.
Look, I only met him once.
What do you mean, once?
Did he find you online?
Wait.
What?
Wait, who did you meet once?
Paul.
Paul, who's
I met him with Joni.
Why was Joni there?
She set it up.
Forget the setup. Who's Paul?
Our sperm donor. Did you guys think I was gay?
No. No way.
Well, of course not.
No way, of course not. But Laser, the teenage son, and sister Joni have tracked down the sperm donor
You know, I've seen this described, Stephanie, as, you know, the movie being about the ecosystem of a family and the way that changes when an exotic species is introduced. But in this case, the exotic species is the male who made the birds possible.
Yeah, that's a very interesting and apt way of looking at it. And he really, you know, he doesn't quite fit into this family, or he doesn't fit in easily, let's put it that way. And the movie ends up in a place, you know, I don't think you can quite see where it's going. And, you know, the transition isn't easy, but it does feel very natural and believable.
There's some kind of morality-based criticism coming from the right here about sperm donors, that, you know, it makes it too possible to have a non-traditional family, and that people can be uncomfortable with that. In the film, what the moral judgment kind of goes the other way. I haven't been able to see it yet, but as Mark Ruffalo gets engaged with the family, I have the sense he comes across as kind of the bad guy.
Well, you know, the thing about families is so many of us make our own families. We make all kinds of families, you know, within our own lives, whether it's by having children biologically, by adopting them, by, you know, having sort of adoptive aunts and uncles, or there are, you know, children of friends that we look after and take care of. So I think, you know, looking at the idea of family through this really narrow lens is not only unrealistic, it's harmful, because, you know, life is a lot more complicated than that.
And these days, complicated in just about every direction, with sperm donation getting a lot of attention from Hollywood this year. Stephanie Zaharik with MovieLine.com, chief movie critic there, joining us from Brooklyn. Thank you very much for being with us, Stephanie.
Thank you.
30 to 60,000 American children born in the country via artificial insemination every year these days. A lot of people are really, well, obviously, living this. Families for whom this is the sort of foundation, of at least biological foundation, of the family. Joining me right now from New York is Katya Hedder. She's a freelance writer in a lesbian marriage. Her 2.5-year-old daughter was conceived through a sperm donor. Katya Hedder, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Are people talking about this film and the Hollywood attention here in your circles, Katya?
They definitely are talking about it. Not a lot of us have seen it yet, but there's quite a buzz about our families being represented in a mainstream movie.
And in such a way that it's the lesbian couple, which are kind of the, you know, bulwark of this family, and the father, the male, the dad, is the interloper. Tell us your story, Stephanie. You went for sperm donation. When and how did you decide to do that, and how'd it go?
Well, the beginning of the story is a pretty standard answer. I met the right person, I fell in love, and I wanted to make a family with her. That's when we had to start investigating how we would do that. So in New York, we're lucky to have a lot of resources. We joined a support group for what I call the wannabe mamas at the New York Gay and Lesbian Center, and we learned all the different ways we could create a family. There was adoption, there was artificial insemination. And we, once we decided that I wanted to give birth to our child, we spent a lot of time searching inside ourselves about what we wanted to have in a donor.
Right. And that meant a sperm donor. So what, you go to a bank, you look at a menu? How's it work?
It's very 21st century. You can go online. We use California Cryobank, and so much of their information is online. It can get a little scary at times. You can put in height requirements, weight requirements, but both of us as writers really wanted a good narrative. We wanted somebody who, at least through the paperwork, appeared kind and loving, and because we're both into food, we really wanted him to be into food too. And
can you do that? Like, that you can check off boxes for kind, loving?
No, but you know,
food lover.
If you're sort of an inquisitive person, you can read the donor fills out extensive surveys, and at California Cryobank, there's actually a staff impression. We had looked at one donor who we thought was fairly interesting, and then the staff impression said he was a little bit arrogant, and I thought, I could never hand that to my daughter and say, he was really good, except he appeared to be also a jerk.
What else? I see here that you asked for somebody who was ethnically Italian.
My partner's Italian, and it's interesting. When you're looking for these kinds of things, you don't know what's going to resonate. And so we actually spent quite a few hours looking over different donor packages that we could print out.
What, were you hoping that the child would have, what, an Italian complexion or an Italian view of life? I mean, what did you know? What do you expect when you ask her?
No idea. Real. I mean, we did think that because I have dark hair and we chose somebody. I'm Cuban.
Yeah.
We thought that the with an Italian donor, we might get dark hair. We weren't hoping for dark hair. And she turns out to be blonde, green-eyed. So I'm thinking maybe he's Northern Italian.
Maybe. All kinds of Italians. Let me ask you this, and this is kind of the one of the questions that the movie may raise is, you know, is the sperm donor your daughter's father?
You know, we definitely call him a donor, and sometimes jokingly we say donor daddy, but she has two parents, and those parents are my partner and me. We had looked into the possibility of a known donor. We couldn't find somebody with the right narrative and really just decided that we wanted to be her two parents.
And will that be the case forever? Will this be, it's anonymous? She'll never know exactly, specifically who her biological father was?
You know, I don't think that's up to me in the end. I think that we've collected everything we can about him, everything that was that we could get for free from California Cryobank, and we paid for everything that we could get from them.
But do you have a name and phone number you can hand her when she turns, I don't know, some age?
Yeah, I hope that California Cryobank still exists and we can hand her the internet address or the phone number and she's free to write a letter and if he's still alive, he's free to respond. I really think that that'll be an evolving process for her. It's not up, in the end, it's not up to me what decisions she makes, what she feels about it. We're just going to provide her with as much information as we can and guide her as her parent.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sperm donor fathers, sperm donor kids, and Hollywood's new interest in test tube daddies. Here's another clip from the new film, The Kids Are All Right, hitting theaters in the next week and two around the country. Lesbian moms Nick Annette Benning and Jules Julianne Moore meet restaurant owner Paul, Mark Ruffalo, the sperm donor of their teenage kids for the first time when they invite him over for dinner in the film. Nick isn't too happy about him intruding on her family and what they're learning.
So, Paul, did you always know that you wanted to be in the food services industry?
I always liked food.
Yeah. No, I was asking because I remember when I was reading your file back when we were looking for, sperm. Sure. Anyway, you said that you were studying international relations.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That was a long time ago. Yeah, I was considering it, but then I dropped out of school.
Oh.
We've been talking with Katya Hedder, freelance journalist. She's got a 2.5-year-old daughter with her lesbian partner, lives in New York. We're glad to have her with us today. Also from New York right now, Deborah Spar is here. She's author of The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. She's also president of Barnard College in New York, previously taught at the Harvard Business School. Deborah Spar, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
I don't know if you've seen it yet. It hasn't hit the theaters. But what do you think of the kind of attention that this spate of films, the Backup Plan, The Switch, and now The Kids Are All Right, are bringing to sperm donors and sperm donation?
Well, I haven't seen the new film, but I think it's a really good thing that the spotlight is being turned on a new form of family building and new kinds of families, and that from what I understand from the new movie, the family is really presented as a fairly traditional family dealing with a whole range of untraditional new developments.
Of course, the traditional family here is a lesbian couple, and the biological father, it turns out, is the exotic piece of this equation. What do you think of that?
Well, it's becoming a bigger and bigger piece of our reality today. What we think of as the traditional family, the mom, the dad, the two genetically conceived children, is no longer the only way of having a family in this country.
How does it work? I mean, I'm reading here 30 to 60,000 kids a year conceived by artificial insemination. Do those numbers sound about right to you? Who tends to do it? And how does it work?
Yeah, well, the numbers do sound about right. One thing that's worth noting is that we really don't have very good numbers on any parts of the fertility industry because it's really occurring sort of outside of any type of regulatory bounds. But essentially, people go to sperm banks when they can't have children the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. And as I understand, there's basically three types of people who will use the banks. About one-third of customers these days are heterosexual couples, where the father or the male in the couple is infertile, and so they have to use donor sperm. About another third are lesbian couples, the type portrayed in the new movie. Mm-hmm. And the last third are single women who want to become moms and have kind of given up on men in the old-fashioned way and are choosing just to get sperm instead.
And what about the oversight or regulation of sperm donation? I'm reading here that it's quite different in different countries. Very little oversight here, quite a lot elsewhere.
No, that's right. The U.S. still remains sort of the Wild West of assisted reproduction in all its various forms. Sperm banking is actually the most heavily regulated part of the fertility industry, in part because it's been around the longest, and in part because in some ways it's the easiest to regulate. So sperm banks do have to follow certain FDA and medical regulations. They have to check the sperm for certain diseases. They have to hold the sperm and check it for HIV/AIDS after some period of time. But other than that, it's pretty much anything goes. So whereas other countries, particularly in Europe, no longer allow for anonymous donations, so the sperm donors have to agree that at some point in time their children can trace them, in the U.S. there's no such regulation. So a man can donate his sperm and pretty much walk away and not have to have any connection or any known way for his children to subsequently trace him.
Katia Hedder, did it feel like the Wild West when you got into your search for the right sperm to make a baby?
It didn't. Because we went to the center and collected information from people who had gone through the process already,
mm-hmm.
And that's the way that you usually collect that kind of information, is you talk to your friends and your colleagues and hopefully your doctor.
Right.
It felt like a pretty stable process, but just hearing you speak about it, it really could use some regulation. There could be a little bit more certainty.
And they're basically checking for AIDS and STDs, and after that, off you go.
Right. And I think we had the experience where the donor, not our donor, but that there was a disease that they started testing for at the bank, and we were a little suspicious that maybe they hadn't started testing for it in time. Maybe they had been delayed. And so we went and talked to our doctors at Columbia University, and they said, yes, we've just started testing for it. Part of the Wild West process of this is that the study of genetics is so new. Doctors are testing for new things every day. And so there are all these diseases they're testing for that they didn't used to. So I try to think of it as a good thing that we're learning more and more about how to have healthy babies.
And what do you think of the fact that in this country, you know, the sperm donor can just show up, make his contribution, walk away, and that's the end of it? There's no connection, no responsibility, not necessarily even any capacity to track him down, I guess.
I think it would be a good thing if there was a national system and national standards. I'm not sure, not having thought about it probably as long as your other guests have, what that system should be exactly. But I do like the idea that you're not just dropping by and then disappearing into the wilderness. At least, even just for medical reasons, I think it's good for a child to know half of their DNA.
I want to mix it up a little bit here. The kids are all right. Takes a very supportive view of a couple in California raising their sperm donor-created children, and they get in trouble when the dad shows up. There's been some reaction to that in this country. It's still kind of a cultural tension point. Bradford Wilcox joins us right now from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's director of the National Marriage Project, associate professor of sociology at the University of Virginia. He had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in the last few days, headlined, "Daddy Was Only a Donor." Brad Wilcox, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, it's good to be here.
What do you think of the trend of more sperm donation going on, families being created this way? We have all kinds of families these days in this country.
Yeah, Tom, that's certainly the case. We have a lot more families in the U.S. today, and there's a lot more diversity. But I think that the talk, both today and more generally, has often been kind of from an adult's perspective. And I think it's important for us to sort of shift our perspective and think about how this change affects our nation's kids. And what the evidence suggests is that on a variety of fronts, including donor insemination, the kids tend to be more likely to suffer. In the case of donor insemination, young adults who've experienced this are much more likely to report loss, confusion, a sense of loneliness, compared to kids who've been either adopted or kids who've been born the old-fashioned way.
So who says, Brad, what's the basis for that assertion, your statements?
Yeah, there's a new report called My Daddy's Name is Donor, which was produced by Elizabeth Marquardt and Norval Glenn and Karen Clark, which surveyed 1,500 young adults, 500 who were conceived naturally, 500 who were adopted, and 500 who were conceived through donor insemination. And this survey is the sort of source of my my report that that kids who are conceived through donor insemination are much more likely to experience psychological distress, a sense of loss, and a sort of concern about their origin. So, for instance, nearly half of kids who were conceived through donor insemination say that the circumstances of my conception bother them, or half say that the sperm donor is half of who I am. And what's also interesting is that they're more likely to report distress than kids who are adopted, who are, of course, also distanced from their biological origins. So I think you have to sort of recognize that this whole development looks a lot different for kids than it does for adults.
You're at the National Marriage Project. I mean, people are going to have their ears very perked up for politics in this survey, right? I mean, you guys favor one man, one woman marriage, I assume.
Well, the National Marriage Project actually doesn't take a position on gay marriage, but the sort of the broader idea here is that what we do see in the literature over and over again is that on average, kids tend to do best in an intact married family. And that's something that, you know, may not be politically popular all the time, but it's certainly borne out by a host of different studies.
Deborah Spahr, what do you think of the assertions of this survey that we're hearing here from Brad Wilcox? He's presenting it as kind of troubled kids.
Well, I think it's too early to say. I mean, we're talking about one survey. I haven't seen the survey yet, but it did come from a group that does have a certain political agenda. I think the point that kids are going to be curious about their genetic identity is a good one. And we've seen that with adopted kids and the history of adoption in this country, that even if kids are adopted into wonderfully intact, happy families, some number of those kids at some point in their lives or may have questions about their genetic parents. And I think we've done the right thing in this country over time by giving adopted kids the opportunity to trace their genetic parents insofar as that information is available. And I do think that as the market for sperm donation evolves and matures, we're going to start seeing pressure from kids as they grow up and become adults who, like adopted kids, may want the ability to trace their genetic fathers, even if they don't necessarily want a relationship with that man. They just may want to have that information. And I think particularly for reasons Akacha mentioned a few moments ago, there may be medical reasons to understand half of your DNA, particularly as we do learn more and more about the genetic basis of disease.
You talk about it as families, as you talk about it as a business as well. And I guess I'm reading here a booming business in this country with the economy down, more young men. This is the Daily Finance reporting, turning to sperm donation as a part-time job. And the U.S. even exporting sperm to other countries where restrictions are greater, and it's not so simple. Let's get our callers in here. Caleb, Somerville, Massachusetts. Caleb, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to start my concern with a quotation, kind of a pop quotation from a song that some of your listeners might know. In the year 6565, you won't need no husband, you won't need no wife, you'll pick your son. You'll pick your daughter, too, from the bottom of a long glass soup. And what's kind of troubling to me about by your previous caller who talked about her extensive search for a donor from the cryobank is not so much the idea of the android, you know, artificial aspect of it. To me is the pick your son, pick your daughter too, in the sense that she had this kind of reductionist premise that even based on the offhand remark that a potential donor could have had an arrogant personality, that would immediately translate into the dispositions, aptitudes, abilities of her progeny.
So you mean if we're looking for a food lover and an Italian, good grades, not arrogant, but isn't that kind of what we do in courtship, Caleb?
I believe so, but I think that when it comes to the production of human individuals, there should be a type of reverence, so to speak, for something that is not selective, something that is not elective, or else I think it kind of mimics the consumerist mentality that ultimately destroys the social bond, destroys the idea of appreciating someone on the basis of them simply being a human, and then secondarily on the basis of them simply being the son or daughter. And I'm a staunch opponent of insemination because I also feel that there are so many people that need to be adopted that could be helped by this idea that the anonymous life has produced me, produced the child, therefore it should be valued as a human. I think that people hold a kind of dangerous level of narcissism and also kind of trivial, consumerist understanding of individuality when they choose to inseminate.
Of course, starting a family is never exactly trivial, but Caleb, let us pick it up. Katya Hedder, what do you hear when you listen to Caleb's concern about a reductionist approach, sort of reducing things down to gene traits? What are you thinking, Katya?
I think that a lot of people do that, whether they're looking for the perfect heterosexual mate or whether they're finding a same-sex partner and looking for anonymous sperm. I think it's all in how you think about it. And when I was mentioning the comment by the staff member, which wasn't actually offhand, it was written down in the package that we, that we got.
Black and white, okay.
I just thought, really, I'm going to hand this to my child? I had been thinking so much about not just who we were picking, but what he or she would think when she saw this material, that I thought, this person needs to read really wonderful. Other people do care about grades. Other people care about PhDs. Some of them care about it in the partner that they choose.
Right, right.
We actually put that aside because I think, like, the kids are all right. You know, you never know if the guy actually finished college. You don't know what field he chose.
Right.
You're gonna roll the dice a little bit, as I think heterosexual couples do. And then when this miracle was born, it blew me away. I mean, we love our daughter so much. She's so funny. She's so great. So you can do all the planning in the world, and birth is just going to happen the way it's going to happen.
There's the yearning right there. I mean, a checklist may put some people off, but then maybe that's in courting as well. In the movie, the daughter's name is Joni, after Joni Mitchell, and the song All I Want comes up at some point in the movie. You know, all I really want our love to do is to bring out the best in me and in you, too. I mean, Brad Wilcox, is there a reason to deny couples like this the joy and the, you know, life nurturing that comes from parenthood?
Well, it's interesting. I think Katya is expressing a certain desire for the biological experience of parenthood and that, you know, biological connection to a child. And yet, ironically, here she's denying that very reality to her daughter in terms of her daughter's capacity to have an ongoing day-to-day connection to a flesh and blood father.
But so she's got two flesh and blood parents, including her biological mom.
Well, but I think the point is that, you know, kids have a desire, a longing to know and be known by both their bio parents. I'm the father of adopted kids, and actually they have that same longing. So I think the point is we have to be sort of cognizant of the fact that what you're doing here is you're deliberately creating a child who can't have an ongoing day-to-day relationship with one of their parents, and that can be, I think, deeply hurtful for a lot of kids. So Katrina Clark, for instance, the Washington Post, wrote a few years ago about her experience as a donor kid. She said, "There was an emptiness that came over me. I realized that I am, in a sense, a freak. I truly hated that I would never have a dad. I finally said what it meant to be donor conceived, and I hated it." This is what I'm talking about.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sperm donor fathers, sperm donor kids, and Hollywood's new interest in test tube daddies, the backup plan, the switch out with Jennifer Lopez, Jennifer Aniston, and now Annette Bening and Julianne Moore, Mark Ruffalo out with The Kids Are All Right. Pretty big movie hitting the theaters over the next couple of weeks, and a lot of talk coming in front of it about the changing shape of American families and where sperm donation fits into all that. Katya Hedder joins us from New York. She's has a 2.5-year-old daughter conceived with a sperm donor, being raised by the two parents, she and her lesbian partner, Deborah Spar is with us. She's president of Barnard College and author of The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. And Bradford Wilcox is with us, director of the National Marriage Project. He wrote the op-ed, Daddy Was Only a Donor, in the Wall Street Journal, raising some concerns about leaving the dad out of the picture. Let's go to our listeners. Danielle in Boston. Danielle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm really excited to hear all your guests this morning. I'm 29 years old. I'm single. No man, no marriage in the future. And as you get older, it's kind of stressful. You know, you want children, you want a family, and you realize that you might not be able to do it in the traditional way,
right,
that, you know, your friends are. And, you know, I only recently started looking into, donor sperm and insemination as a possibility, and the relief to know that that option is available. Not quite as stressed now about, you know, meeting the one. And, because you get stressed about, as you get older, this you hear about, you know, you only have this certain window.
Sure, the biological clock, particularly if you're a woman, is ticking at a certain point.
Exactly, you know, and I'm a children's librarian, too, so I'm with families all day, I'm with children, I'm with babies, and so the alarm is ringing.
But what about Brad Wilcox's perspective that, you know what, you really need two parents in here, and in his view, though not Koch's and not many others, but in his view, you know, you need a father and a mother in the picture.
You know, and that is exactly, I brought this up with my parents, you know, very excited to say, oh my goodness, look at this opportunity, this option I have. And that was their reaction about, well, you know, what about a dad? What are you going to tell them where they came from? What do you, you know, and honestly, I haven't quite decided about that yet. I think as the time gets closer where it seems to be more of something that I decide that I'm going to do, I think I'll make a decision. Right now, you know, I'm at the, you know, point of sort of researching it and seeing how other people have gone about it.
And you're excited for the option. It's a relief, you say, Danielle, and we hear that. Thank you for your call, Danielle. Katja Hedder, you're listening in New York. What are you hearing that? I mean, what's your advice to Danielle? You've got two parents involved, two women, but two parents involved in raising your daughter, and it can be a big job.
It's exhausting, and I spend most of my time at home. We're both a little bit older. We're in our 40s now, and I would say to anybody considering having a child at all, by whatever means you choose, make sure you spend a lot of time around children and make sure you're ready for it, because it is 24 hours, 7 days a week. I actually think that in her case, the relief of knowing there's another option may make her just live life, and who knows what'll happen. But I think a single parent has a whole other set of issues to think about, too. Are you ready to either be on call all the time alone or create a community? As we have with two parents, we've created a community of friends and family who support us. It is the village.
Brad Wilcox, Deborah Spar reports to us that about one-third of people using artificial insemination, sperm donors, are single women. You know, Danielle describes this as a relief. She's 29. Here's a clock ticking. Is it your worst nightmare from your perspective, Brad?
Well, Tom, certainly my worst nightmare. I was raised by a single mom. I think that she did a pretty good job. But the point that I'd make as a sociologist is that you're dramatically increasing your kids' risks of some negative outcomes. Things like, you know, doubling their odds of ending up, you know, being arrested by the police, or doubling their odds of having a problem with drugs and alcohol. So the point that I would make is that when we, as a society, as parents, are attentive to things like seat belts and smoking, these are things that don't have as much of an impact on a kid's, you know, health as whether or not they're being raised by, you know, by their married mom and dad. So I think that that's the kind of thing that Danielle should take into account when she's thinking about this potential option in her future.
Here's a note from our website. It says, my husband and I have a 15-year-old donor son. We consider the donor our son that our donor son has a dad as well. He said, we did become intrigued by the possibility of half-siblings, I guess other kids born from this father's sperm donation, and now have had several reunion with eight of his siblings. out of 10 from this anonymous donor dad. We love the half-siblings and their parents, and we'll continue to keep in touch all over the country. I found that although we're curious about the donor, we all have not taken the step to search. That's from Lori. Wow. In touch with a whole lot of half-siblings and not the dad. Harriet in Newton, Massachusetts. Harriet, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm in my 50s, mm-hmm. and I'm a single parent. I gave birth to my daughter 11 years ago, and it's the best thing I ever did. I was a clinical social worker working with kids and families, knew I wanted to be a parent, had been in many relationships with men, and the right one just didn't come along.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit my 40s, and I knew I wanted to have my own child. I did not want to adopt. I wanted to know that what was going on with that fetus for 9 months. And I was living out in California at the time. I went to California Cryobank.
Mm-hmm.
What was important to me was picking a donor who was willing to be identified to my daughter, to my child. I didn't know she'd be a girl.
Mm-hmm.
To my child when she turned 18. Because I felt that I was making this choice to have a child on my own. She or he was not choosing to not have
mm-hmm.
a father.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted her to be able to meet him.
So and you got that ability to do that, and you plan to get them in touch when she's 18?
Well, it's her decision,
mm-hmm.
and we talk about it a lot. I mean, from the time that she was aware of the fact that other kids had dads and that some kids had two moms, we talked about her donor dad.
What does she say to you about having a donor dad? She's 11 now. How does she think about it?
When she was younger, it was hard, and she would talk about meeting him, and it was the fantasy of having a relationship with him. As she's gotten older, it really hasn't even come up that much recently. I think that, I mean, she definitely wishes that we had a dad, and I think when I did this, my hope, expectation was that by this point in her life,
mm-hmm.
I would have met someone and
mm-hmm.
married,
mm-hmm.
and she'd have a father.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the reality is that I could have married at a younger age, had a child, kids, and be divorced.
Mm-hmm.
So I could be a single parent.
Yeah,
with or
lots of ways.
Support of a husband. I see many of our friends and the relationships that the parents have with each other. Some are great and are raising the kids together, and some, the burden all falls to the mother anyways.
Is that donor the father in your mind, Harriet, or not?
He's the genetic father. And again, my daughter would tell you this, too, if she were home and on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
He's the genetic dad. And she's curious about him, and we joke about she got her little cleft chin from him and her beautiful hazel eyes.
Mm.
But... it doesn't come up. I leave it to her to bring up questions that she has or anything. I have not shared with her the written information that I have. I certainly will at some point, and she'll probably listen to this evening and may ask for it then. So I should be sure I have it available.
All right.
What struck me when I was looking at the information about him was he had a sense of humor. I could tell that from his answers to questions,
mm-hmm.
and that was important to me. There's so much that you can think about, and I would say to myself, if I were in love with someone and we were married, I wouldn't care whether he had an aunt who had a gambling problem. You know, you get a lot of information about people, and you can be very nitpicking, but to me it was that sense of, he has a sense of humor. The person at the sperm bank who had met him said he just had a nice manner, and I'm eternally grateful to him because having this child was the best thing that I ever did.
Harriet, we wish the very best to you and to your daughter, and I'm glad for your call. Deborah Spar, you've looked a lot at this, and I guess you don't really come to this with a political perspective, but I just wonder what you're thinking as you listen to couples or single women in this case looking for to conceive a child this way, about how they think about selecting the donor and how it's like and unlike looking for a husband or a partner in the physical world.
Yeah, well, let me go back for just a second to mm-hmm. something your last caller just said. She talked about wanting her own child. And I think that's the drive that's propelling all sorts of people to find children through whatever means they can.
Well, she put that in terms of bearing it for 9 months, but of course there's more than that involved.
That's right. And I would say, and Katya mentioned this earlier, when people find that child, whether they give birth to it or they adopt it or however they get there, they see their child as a miracle. They see their child as their own. And kind of the process by which they got there all disappears. This is their kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two kids the old-fashioned way and then adopted my third.
Mm-hmm.
My adopted child is every bit as much my own as my genetic child. So I would hope we don't leave that part out of the equation. In terms of people selecting characteristics, I mean, I think it makes us all queasy because we never used to do it that way. You didn't sit down and say, gee, I'd love to have a kid with a cleft chin and a volleyball playing inclination. So I think it makes us uncomfortable when we see people going to sperm banks and saying, yes, SAT scores, yes, volleyball, yes, Italian. But that's just kind of part of the new reality. And I think we're just going to have to get used to that. It's happening in the sperm market. It's happening in the egg market. It happens even in the adoption market where people find their children online. So it's unnatural in some ways, but it's the new reality.
The new reality. Let's go to Nashville and Meg. Hi, Meg. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I was calling because I just wanted to talk about the whole idea of what a father is. I have a partner of 11 years, and we have an 18-month-old son. And we had our gay best friend donate for us, and he chose not to go by father. He chose a Cherokee term that means spiritual guide because he thought it was important that the two parents that were going to be raising this child aren't undermined with, once he gets older, this idea of this father figure somewhere out there that has just as much bearing over our relationship with him as he would.
So you're a two-mom family. It's a friend who donated the sperm in this case, but he doesn't go by dad. He goes by spiritual guide.
Yes. Well, it's ALO is what he goes by, but it meant spiritual guide, and he picked that term out.
Right, right. Do you and your partner feel that there's just no need, no benefit, to have a, as you put it, father figure in the scene, or that it's even a potential problem?
It's an issue. I don't think it's an issue. Our best friend, we do see him. He lives in Chicago, and we're in Nashville, and we do see him, you know, four or five times a year. And his parents actually did decide to go by grandparents. So when we're visiting them, they call themselves grandparents. But I don't think it's an issue. And I keep hearing Mr. Wilcox saying that these kids are going to end up, you know, lost and all this stuff. But what about all these single or these women who just got pregnant without even being married, these 16-year-old kids who get married, and they never see their fathers either? You know, I don't understand why this is even an issue is, I guess, the main reason I was calling.
Yeah, that's true. A huge number of American children these days born outside marriage, certainly.
Exactly. I'd say a lot more than gay women out there trying to get impregnated. It's more, there's a lot more single mothers out there.
Brad Wilcox, what do you say to Meg's point there?
I think that Meg makes a great point about the sort of rise of single parenthood across our culture, across our country. And we know that these kids aren't doing so well. I'm just making the point that kids who are conceived through donor insemination seem to have many of the same problems and troubles that kids who are born to young single mothers and kids who are born to middle-aged, middle-class single mothers.
Katya, are you buying that, this notion, you know, that you should anticipate problems because you have a sperm donor child?
I think I should anticipate problems because I have a child. I've worked with teenagers, and I know what's coming. And the thing that you have to keep aware of when you're a parent is you don't really know what's coming. Be prepared for the unexpected. And I think there are going to be a lot of studies coming out, as I have now gay couple friends who are having children through surrogates. We're going to see how it all plays out. I mean, there was a study out of the University of California at San Francisco that showed that children in lesbian families actually did better on average. They were more sensitized. They were more aware of the issues. But I think the most important thing in being a parent, however you decide to become a parent, is to be loving, somewhat sane, set the boundaries, say no occasionally, make vegetables taste good. I mean, I've done it. It's this, you know,
it's
we
a
are
challenge.
You know, it's you just we're and our family is not just two mommies and a kid. You know, it's mm-hmm. other families that support us. It's the grandparents who fly in. You know, it's the cousins who have our kids' curly hair. It's the cousins who don't look anything like her and adore her. You know, she's the baby of the family.
And on it goes.
And on, yeah, it's the same stories. So I think the fact that we are deliberately choosing to be parents, that we work really hard to do it, that we spend lots of money that other people don't spend, trying to get a child.
In the process, yeah.
In the process, whether we're adopting or trying to do it through artificial insemination. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think our kids are adored, and maybe they'll get too much attention. but I'm not worried about our child's, ability to function in the future. I think because she comes from a slightly different background, she'll probably be able to navigate different ways of living, different parts of the country, different parts of the world.
Sounds like that's going to be necessary in this complex new skein of relationships that we're moving into. Katya Hedder in New York, we're very grateful to you for your generosity and your candor today. And thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Brad Wilcox at the National Marriage Project in Charlottesville, Virginia. Bradford Wilcox, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Deborah Spar, this is a new world.
It is indeed.
Wow, we're headed into some new terrain. We'll talk about it more. Thank you for joining us. The book is The Baby Business, president of Barnard College. Deborah Spar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.